Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? I hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. It is, of course, a little bit late on a Friday for a regular Arscast, but that was because the recording I had set up for yesterday, we couldn't go through with it in the end, so we had to put it off until this morning. Nevertheless, there is a big day of podcasting ahead for us here, for me, for you, for your ears. I hope you're set up for it. By the time you will have listened to this, there will already have been the first podcast of the day available on your feed, in your podcast app, on Patreon, wherever you get your podcasts. Tim Stillman with an exclusive interview with Arsenal goalkeeper Manuela Zinsberger. He met with her last week in the wake of her putting pen to paper on a new contract. That is available for you right now. A little later on, we will be talking to Dr. Andrew Mitchell, Associate Dean at the University of Bedfordshire. We did a podcast on Patreon with him earlier in the season, back in August, I think. We touched on some issues around injuries, player development, rehab, recuperation, injury prevention, and lots more. And we thought it would be good to revisit that in some way, but also take questions from you guys. So we've done that. We took questions on Twitter. We took questions from our Discord. And we're going to record that a little bit later on this afternoon at 3 o'clock. That will be available for you around, I would say, 4:15, 4:30-ish. And then after that, we will do what we normally do for our Patreon members, which is preview the upcoming Premier League game at the weekend, which, of course, is our trip to West Ham. So myself and Lewis Ambrose will have that for you over on Patreon a little bit later on this evening as well. So there's a lot going on the microphone today, and hopefully this will be enough to tide you through the weekend before we do get to play West Ham on Sunday. As for today's show, those of you who listen regularly will know that I talk to Ken Early from Second Captains at the start of every season for a sort of broad look at what's going on in the Premier League, what we expect, and all that. And usually, it doesn't always happen, but usually we try and hook up again mid-season to see where we are. Now, I know it's not mid-season. We're 22, 23 games in, and we're a little over the halfway mark. But in the wake of Arsenal's impressive and important 3-1 win over Liverpool at the weekend, where they currently sit top of the table on 51 points, Manchester City 49, Arsenal 49. It's all very tight up there, all very exciting, and it felt like a good time to have another conversation with Ken about the season so far and what's left to come. So why don't we just get on and do that? It is my pleasure to welcome back to the Arscast from Second Captains, Ken Early. Hi, Ken.
Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you very much. It's nice to catch up. You know, normally we try and do it at kind of the halfway point in the season, but we're a little bit over that, 22, 23 games in. Nevertheless, I think it is quite an interesting point at which to reconvene after our preseason chat, because top of the table is quite interesting. Arsenal's win over Liverpool last weekend meant that the gap was 2 points rather than 8 points, and Liverpool are top, City are second, Arsenal in third, City and Arsenal on the same points, but City have a game in hand. How do you view the title race? Is there anything about what's happened this season that has been a surprise to you in any way, or is this sort of an exciting trio of teams, you know, to take us towards May and the denouement of this season?
Well, it's been a lot more interesting than I was expecting it to be in August, and the surprise element to it is the involvement of Liverpool in it, which certainly I wasn't expecting. And I mean, I had several times throughout the kind of autumn going into winter, I would think back to the first one of these we did this season and cringe because, you know, that those sort of intrusive thoughts of, oh God, like when you, you know, when you think about something that, something flashes back into your memory of last night when you were drinking, and then you, did I say that? Oh God.
Oh God.
Because
the fear.
I think talking to you, I'd essentially written off Liverpool saying this Jurgen Klopp thing is over. It's finished. It's run its course. you know, he's had it. It's finished. And obviously they had this amazing first half of the season. I mean, amazing compared to anything certainly I was predicting for them. And it was only when he announced that actually he was burnt out and fed up and he was gone. I thought, well, you know, maybe I was onto something after all. You know, I thought, I thought the guy was looking a bit beaten down last year. You know, it seemed like he was looking like, oh, I don't really know what to do with these guys anymore. And I kind of hate some of them as well. And, you know, they kind of don't seem to really like... I must say, actually, I was right. So that great moment of, you know, shared sadness that everybody had. Well, I mean, not everybody was sad to see Jurgen Klopp announcing he was going to leave, but there was for me a certain amount of personal vindication and relief as well. You know, so them being involved has obviously been a surprise, but obviously it was a big setback for them when they lost to Arsenal, and that's a kind of a pattern that they've had, you know, not being able to win those games this season. You know, they didn't beat Arsenal at home or away. They obviously lost away. They couldn't beat Manchester United at home, which looks like a very bad result. Lost away to Tottenham, couldn't beat Chelsea away, drew away to Man City, which wasn't such a bad result. But, you know, there aren't any wins in this comp. They did beat Chelsea at home recently. But that's been a problem. But of course, they've had good enough results to be top of the table at this point. Although City in reality are top of the table, I think, with their 2-point gap and the game in hand. Otherwise, it's been kind of the only difference between what you would have expected at the start of the season. What's actually happened is City have not been as good, and that's really it. You know, I mean, yeah. I think Arsenal have pretty much. Have been at about par in terms of their results. Not quite as good as last season's, you know, first 22 games or whatever. But it's very difficult to reach those levels every season. I mean, they won nearly every game at this point last season.
I mean, that was Arsenal's best ever start to a league season. So I think there was always going to be a, you know, not quite reverting to the mean, but it's very difficult to keep up those kinds of standards. I mean, what's your assessment of mid-season Arsenal? There have been some, you know, there was a difficult period over Christmas, obviously. The football is different from last season. The sort of lightning in a bottle experience that we had as Arsenal fans, where all of a sudden you're going, holy shit, this team is really, really good and probably a bit better than we expected. I think it requires a manager and his staff to do things a little bit differently next time around, because you can't sort of just recapture that. You have to try and develop in a way. And I think there have been certain signs of that with Arsenal. There are still, you know, things that they can do better, things that they can improve. But is the ability to, you know, be there, be in the mix at the top of the table while, you know, still having that room for improvement a positive thing for Arsenal? Or is it one of those where, okay, you're kind of hanging on by your fingernails and it could go wrong?
No, I think Arsenal are in a great position. You know, I mean, last season they were in that we're leading. I mean, but at the end of January last season, I thought they were going to actually win the league. And then obviously City went on. Because if you remember City, again, the first half of the season last season wasn't as good as the second half turned out to be for City. And, you know, Arsenal, I think after the win against Aston Villa and then... Was the Brentford game, the Reece Nelson game? Was it Brentford or Bournemouth?
Bournemouth.
Those were moments when it looked as though. But you know, it's a different kind of pressure. The feeling of we're in a position where we we kind of should win it now. And they're the, you know, City were the ones who were kind of in the chasing position, which I think they find quite comfortable.
Mm.
And, you know, Arsenal hadn't been in that situation before. So eventually we all know what happened. I think the situation they're in now, I mean, they have the experience of last season. It's a question of whether they can beat Manchester City.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it comes down to. I mean, it kind of came down to that last season as well. And we know how it went. But this season, I think they've probably got a better chance of actually doing it, because if you look at their record in these big games, it's been very good. I mean, they completely snuffed out Liverpool.
Yeah.
The other day, you know, Liverpool couldn't get into that game at all. Couldn't do anything in midfield at all. Just couldn't, you know, they were backs to the wall the whole game, it felt like.
Mm.
And you don't see that happen to them very often.
No.
And if they can do that to Liverpool, I don't see why they can't also do that to Manchester City.
Well, they've already beaten Manchester City this season, in fairness. You know, it is at home, but obviously away is a different prospect, for sure, you know, because of how City are in the second half of the seasons in particular. I mean, Barney Rone wrote a piece in the Guardian this week. He was talking about Manchester City in annihilation mode. He said, you know, the Death Star is preparing its destructor beam. And it's hard to kind of escape that sense or fear or realization or reality, I guess, when it comes to Manchester City, because this is what they do, and this is how they've won so many titles, that what they do in the second half of the season feels just so relentless and so inevitable. Is it important? How important is it, rather, or is it actually important for the Premier League to go somewhere other than Manchester City this season? Does it make any big difference to the Premier League as a product? I think, you know, many neutral fans would probably prefer to see another team win it, just for at least the sake of some sense of competition. Because what would this be? This would be 6 out of the last 7 for Manchester City if they go on and win it this season. And I do have a question about the competitiveness of the Premier League, which I'll put to you in a moment. But in terms of who can actually win the title and who's capable of going the distance, is it important for the Premier League to be able to sell itself around the world as the best league in the world while one team is just winning it season after season?
Well, I mean, obviously we're all still watching it. And, you know, Man City have been doing this for a while, and it continues to be, you know, far bigger than the other leagues. It's not as though I haven't really detected any currents of, oh, this Premier League isn't really, you know, it's not that good anymore, you know, it's just Man City winning. Because the fact is, like, you just keep getting brilliant games, you know, like, there's so many good players in the Premier League now. Yeah. Because of it being so much richer than all the others, that you get, you know, they've just had a 45 goal you know, match week,
yeah,
which is a record or whatever. You know, there's a lot of brilliant games in there, which you don't, I mean, most people aren't watching the Man City game. It's just like, oh, well, City got 3 points again. You know what I mean? But it's there is enough to sort of be getting on with.
You get a 4-4 with Luton Newcastle, for example, and that's just mayhem and entertainment.
Yeah, you know, so like week by week, I think there's a lot to like, and then at the end of it, Man City win the league. I'm sure they would love, the Premier League would definitely rather somebody other than Manchester City was able to win it, but, you know, there's not much they can do about that. As long as Man City keep winning every game. So I don't know. Like, I mean, I don't think it's good. And obviously the whole issue with City at the moment is that, you know, where well, they've broken all these rules, and it's sort of, well, if they hadn't broken the rules, I say they've broken these rules. I mean, that's yet to be established or proven. But were that to happen, then it's a case of, well, you know, this team broke a lot of rules, got into a very dominant position, you know, won, what, 6 out of 7 or 5 out of 6 league titles. And now it all looks a bit Juventus. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's obviously not good. I mean, the thing is that Serie A, I mean, I remember Serie A in the 80s and 90s being what the Premier League is now, in terms of it was regarded around the world as the highest standard league.
Sure.
It had the star players, you know, it had the best players in the world tended to show up at Italian clubs. And it was quite competitive in terms of different teams were able to win the league or challenge for the league. So it had all these elements. And it was really only when they started enforcing some rules that the whole shine went off the thing, you know, when they found that Juventus had been nobbling refs all along, you know, and demoted them, that it sort of, that, I mean, the demotion of Juventus while richly in 2006, while richly deserved, did really damage the standing of the league. You know, it's like, first of all, what Inter started winning it every year, but like no one really took it seriously because everybody, you know, Juventus were an integral part of the league, even though they were cheats and they deserved to be relegated. But the overall impact of punishing them, of actually enforcing, you know, the rules against them was to damage the league. So that's the situation maybe the Premier League has as well. It could be Case City end up getting punished, you know, deservedly. We don't know what's going to happen or how, you know, the evidence. I'm sure City's legal team will have a lot to say. But even if they do end up getting punished, that's going to be bad for the league as well in a couple of different ways. Retrospectively, in terms of all of the titles that they've had, which are now tainted, and also going forward in terms of maybe the best team in the league isn't going to be there or has been kind of taken out in some unnatural way. You know, it's not a good situation, but for now they just keep plugging away.
I mean, it's kind of mad when you talk about Serie A and what happened to Juventus, and then they came back and won, what was it, 7 or 8 in a row, maybe more?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but I mean the whole league, I think, had taken a nose off.
Oh, sure.
It wasn't just the punishment of you, and Juventus, of course, weren't the only club punished in relation to that, but they were the biggest, and it was the biggest punishment. I mean, there was also in the background the economic growth of the Premier League was going on at a pace that Serie A couldn't keep up with. La Liga was the kind of gold standard league during the Messi and Ronaldo era, and you know, largely because those clubs were paying the highest wages in the world, Real Madrid and Barcelona. You know, they were taking the best players from Premier League clubs, you know, Fabregas, Suarez, Bale, you know,
sure.
they had Ronaldo, of course, they had their pick of the best players. Now that the Premier League really, I think, is in that position, which is what is making it kind of irresistible at the moment. I mean, I think this season has really been brilliant so far. In terms of the number of things happening, I mean, Tottenham have been very interesting, a lot more so than you would have maybe expected, given their form at the end of last season, you know, losing Harry Kane and so on. Manchester United have been, you know, compelling as always. Chelsea, you know, a never before seen way to fail. They're showing us something we've never seen before. No one has done this before. And that is, you know, you just don't get these types of things happening in other leagues. You just don't. No team spends £1 billion on transfers in, you know, the space of barely over a year and does this.
Yeah.
And that's why it continues to be, you know, the top spectacle.
I mean, do you think it is more competitive, despite the Manchester City thing and the sort of procession to the title that they've enjoyed? For whatever reason, you know, there is obviously a very strong sporting element to it in that they have a very good structure and the best manager in the world, but that's all tied to the money and how that money has been procured and all the rest. But beyond that, do you think it's more competitive than it has been? I was looking at this, like the gap between first and fifth this season after 22 games is 7 points. Last season, it was 11 points. Season before that, 20 points. Season before that, again, was 11 points. But the season before that, which I think was maybe the COVID season, I can't remember, but the gap between first and fifth was 30 points. So there's been sort of like an equalization of talent, quality, ability. You know, a team like, we talked about surprises. You know, I think Arsenal fans will have been especially surprised by what Aston Villa have done this season, because I don't think anyone expected that from Aston Villa. And we have our own experience of Unai Emery, which is, you know, doesn't tally with what Villa are doing and how they're doing it and where they are in the table. So, you know, do you think it is, in spite of all the focus on City and their 115 charges, that in general, it is a much more competitive league than maybe people think.
I think it has been. And I think it's ultimately a result of just the quality of players that you find, you know, at every, you know, if you look at every team, I mean, Palace are 14th. Like Olise and Eze are brilliant players.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, Forest have got really good players. They're like 16th in the league. I mean, every team apart from, to be honest, there hasn't been too much to impress anyone at Burnley and Sheffield United this season. Every other team has got like reasons to watch them, you know, or to sort of strengths in the team, which on a given day can make a difference. So, I do feel that. Like, I mean, if you look at the moment, Liverpool are top. They've drawn six and lost two. I mean, if you think back to Man City's Centurion season 2018, they finished with, I think their record at the end was 132, drawn four, lost two. So that was that was how they got the 100 points. So so already the leaders after 23 games this season have dropped more points than City dropped in the entire season 2018, which is, I think, you know, an indication that, yeah, at least there's nobody quite so far ahead. I mean, at the moment I'm looking at it, and Man City can still get, I think, 97 points. And I feel like they're probably going to get over 90. And whenever you get over 90, it's like, okay, this team was well ahead of, usually it means this team is well ahead of everyone, but we'll see. We've got a few more games to go.
Just back to Jurgen Klopp very quickly. How much do you think his sort of burnout and his decision to call it quits is related to Man City rather than just sort of 8 years in a job, in a very high pressure, high stress job in, you know, in the Premier League? That there must be a sort of, it must make you exhausted to do as well as Jurgen Klopp has done at Liverpool and not win more. And he's maybe a bit unfortunate or whatever you want to call it to exist within the era of Manchester City. But it feels to me anyway that there's a fairly strong through line between City and his decision.
I don't think so.
No?
I think he's used to it. I mean, he's spent like the last, 10 years of his life losing to Pep Guardiola. you know, I mean, Guardiola came in at Bayern. I mean, Bayern, to be fair, had won the title in 2013. Klopp had won the previous two with Dortmund. Bayern won the title in 2013. And that was when Guardiola arrived in 13-14. Jupp Heynckes had won that first post, the first title. Klopp was going for three in a row. Jupp Heynckes won the title. Since then, it's been Guardiola. Guardiola obviously won the league the two seasons that they were competing against each other in Germany. And then they both arrived in England, Klopp a half season before Guardiola. And since then, it's just been Guardiola beating Klopp. So what is he up to now? This is going to be eight out of 9 years that they've competed against each other. I'm assuming, I'm making the working assumption City are going to win it again this year. I'm sure that is annoying to him, but I think it's also just been the way that it is. It's like I think that he's probably been enjoying his work and, you know, enjoying what Liverpool have done. And, you know, it's been a great job for him. You know, I don't get the sense that he's like broken or frustrated by multiple disappointments in the job. I think that he's literally just, you know, on a physical level, feeling older than he was. I mean, you remember Wenger talking about, I remember Wenger talking about, I think it was around the time of his 60th birthday, which would have been, 2009. And people are like, oh, you know, you're 60, it's a big milestone, Arsene. And he was talking about like the animal strength you need to do this job, you know? You need animal, which obviously he still felt that he had. Although even then he was talking about sort of losing a bit of energy. I think that's really what's going on here. I mean, Klopp like smokes a lot, you know. He's not. I don't know if he's in great nick physically. You know, if you look back to Klopp in his first season, you'd see him charging down the touchline, like leaping in the air. Do you remember? I think it was a game against Arsenal. There was a 3-3 draw between Arsenal and Liverpool
at the Emirates.
No, I think it was at Anfield. It was the relay call by Joe Allen. It's going back years, and I think there was a big jump. You never see Klopp jumping in the air anymore. I can't remember the last time I saw the man jump. Now you can still manage without jumping. That's, you know, it's not a core skill, but I think it is reflective of like, you know, you listen to him. The thing that he complains about is not Man City. He has complained a little bit about Man City. I mean, he's had a few pops at, like, you know, there are three teams who can do what they want, and he's talking about City, PSG, and Newcastle. But mainly the thing he's talking about is fixtures and how many there are and how they're cramming the calendar more and more. And he complains about this all the time. You know, it's more than anybody else, I think, and more consistently than anyone else in football. Mm. And, you know, I guess... the assumption was, well, he's talking about the players having to do this, and they're getting burned out and so on and so forth. He's talking about himself as well, you know? Oh my God, I'm up at 5, I'm going to the airport again. Or, you know, this kind of, it's like, I honestly think that is the reason. I think Germany tried to hire him, I think, after they got rid of, I mean, towards the start of this season. Germany were hiring him, trying to hire him. And I think at that point he thought, Jesus, I kind of fancy this job. But if I leave now, I'm kind of leaving a loser. You know, I'm sort of, last season, his last full season would have been this awful kind of a failure. And then he would have been sort of leaving them in the lurch at the beginning of a new season. Mm. I think he felt like that would be bad. But I feel that that's what he wants to do now. He would like to be the Germany national team manager, and I think will probably be their manager at the 2026 World Cup. I mean, all going well. I think that's probably his career plan, because I think he still obviously wants to be a manager, and there are still things he would like to do in football. I mean, he's only 56 still, but maybe this type of really intense, you know, game, press conference is just, he's burned out by it. I honestly believe that's what's going on. So the more, you know, the sort of 10 game a year schedule of being an international manager is something which would appeal to him. And, you know, the opportunity to manage Germany in the World Cup, a World Cup in the United States, maybe win the World Cup with Germany, that would be a really big deal. Mm. You know, that's like, that's not just some sort of retirement clock, you know, token nonsense. I mean, sure. that would be huge. It would be the opportunity to do in the coaching sphere what Messi has done, what Messi managed to do in 2022. You know what I mean? To succeed, to have the sort of ultimate success on at both levels of the game. And I think that sort of interests him, as does all the time off that you would get. So, we'll see how that goes. But I don't think it's just a question of, oh, I've lost to City too many times, I can't do this anymore. I think he's always been happy to sort of be the underdog. I mean, when I say the underdog, I mean the second biggest dog. The second biggest dog in the race, rather than sort of being the Death Star commander.
Sure.
And I think he could have kept doing that if he was still feeling as he did 10 years ago.
You had a podcast on Monday I thought was quite interesting, especially in the wake of some of the stuff we saw after the Arsenal-Liverpool game, celebration, police and all the rest of it. You were talking to Jonathan Wilson about pundits and punditry and club colours and the way media, or the way football rather, is being covered now on the main channels like Sky Sports, like TNT and beyond, where the sort of the role of the pundit has shifted quite a bit over the last number of years, where you would have an ex-player from a certain club and you kind of knew that there was you know, an association, a bias, whatever you want to call it. But the job itself called for a certain amount of objectivity. And that is, I think the lines have become a little bit blurred there over the last number of years, maybe because of the Carragher-Neville dynamic and the rivalry between Liverpool and Manchester United. I mean, do you think it's a problem for football punditry? Or is it just a sort of natural consequence of where we are with the way people consume media these days, with what people are looking for, where they do have their fan outlets, whether it's Arseblog or Anfield Rap or whatever it might be? You know, they can always get that anyway. But this sort of blurring of the media lines between sort of fan-created content and actual mainstream media has a different era of punditry and how the game is going to be covered from now on.
Well, I think we were talking to Jonathan Wilson about this, and he was saying, well, you know, the pundit should be there to do this and should be there to provide analysis and so on. But that's not what people want, clearly, right? What people want is the transmission of emotion. I say it in that weird way because that's how they say it in Spain, where they've been doing this for a much longer time because they cottoned onto this much earlier, that this is actually what people want. And they've had it in Spain, they've had it in Italy. You know, you see those TV shows where like there's this old guy with a mustache who's like the world's biggest Milan fan. And every time Milan does, you know, he kind of runs around the studio, this old guy runs around celebrating. And everybody is watching this going, this is incredible. I love this. Or Thomas Roncero is, you know, one of the sort of star journalists in Spain. And he's just like, he's just the sort of Real Madrid Goebbels, you know. he will literally cry on television, you know, if some injustice happens to Real Madrid. And yeah. he can imagine an injustice out of anything. Like, this is his gift. And people can't stop watching this, you know. Well, I mean, people can't stop watching it. But let's say the sort of tear-streaked hysteria of Thomas Roncero comfortably outcompetes the sober analysis of, well, I don't know who's still doing that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why would you do that? And, you know, it's not as though people are, most people when they watch football are objective about it anyway. And the whole point is not to be objective, you know, in terms of why people enjoy watching it. Like, you can't enjoy it if you are completely objective. The idea is to identify with a team, and then if the team wins, you know, you share in the happiness, and if the team loses, then you're angry and despondent. You know, that's kind of the point of the exercise.
Yeah. I mean, what was Jonathan's point? Not sort of like, well, I mean, there is a distinction, obviously, between the role of a pundit and, let's say, a journalist or a reporter. And I think where he took some issue was the idea that as a reporter, as somebody who's there ostensibly to cover the game objectively, depending on the outlet you work for example, like if you're working for Marca or if you're working for El Mundo Deportivo, your objectivity is very different, you know. But the role of the pundit is different from that of a journalist. They are there to sort of maybe provide some analysis, which I think, you know, some of them do very well. And, you know, even some of the guys who are like Carragher got pelters over the weekend for his get down the tunnel stuff to Martin Odegaard, right? Understandably so.
But which was a bad moment for him, I thought.
Sure. But like on Monday Night Football, he produced some really good analysis on the way Arsenal defended against Liverpool. Mm. So, you know, it is possible to, on the one hand, you know, let your club bias shine through and you get pilloried for it. But on the other, you're capable of producing some good stuff. But the punditry role in and of itself versus that of a journalist, I think, is different.
Well, I think Carragher has always been a really good analyst. You know, like, I mean, I think that's the reason why he kept his job following the previous incident, you know, which was mentioned a lot in the wake of the Odegaard stuff. Every time there was a tweet about it, you could see people in the replies talking about, well, what, you know, we know what happened there. The reason that that he's still working for Sky after that is because they were like, well, he is actually really good. Maybe a couple of months suspension, you know, and it sort of was all right. I think that the thing that you can see with Carragher, besides the fact that he's clearly a massive Liverpool fan who was really angry watching Odegaard celebrate this, what for him was a painful result, is that he actually has a real passion for the game itself, which I don't think, for instance, Gary Neville really still has.
I agree with that.
Neville is like, Neville's got bigger fish to fry now. You know, he's kind of, he's moved into other fields. You know, he's got like a million, he's juggling a million different balls, of which football is one. Carragher, I think, is still really into football, which is why he's able to still sort of produce interesting thoughts about the actual game as it's played. You know, the sort of, he can come up with these interesting segments of analysis, which it's a while, I can't really remember. It's a while since I've seen Neville do that. And in that respect, I think Carragher's better than most of the pundits. Obviously, he has more time to do it. Like, he's running that Monday Night Football show. You know, there's not many people, there's not many pundits who are given that sort of canvas, let's say, to show us their thoughts about the game. Maybe there are others who could do what Carragher does, but I'd say he's probably the best in that respect. Where did I start with this? what was I talking about at the beginning?
We were talking about sort of pundits, journalists.
Being kind of biased. Like, I mean, I think what you get often is also this sort of overcorrection, where because everybody knows the pundit is there to be like the with Neville, the Manchester United pundit, he's like, he just is kind of quite negative about Manchester United, I think, to the extent of almost I don't want people to accuse me of just being biased in favor of Manchester United all the time. Why don't I slaughter them now? But never in a very interesting way. It's always, well, the owners, the culture here is toxic, blah, 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 blah. And at the end of it, you're kind of like, oh, this isn't really that interesting, you know?
Mm.
I don't know. Like, I mean, part of it is obviously, I mean, Martin Keown, for example.
Yeah.
Martin Keown is sometimes funny to watch when he starts, you know, you see him on with like Simon Jordan or whatever, and he gets actually angry about some Arsenal-related thing. I mean, the thing is, you want to watch this sort of stuff. Like, Keown may be spouting nonsense, but you do want to watch an angry man sort of in a slightly flustered way refuting some needling points that are being put to him by, you know, in an argument. I mean, that's just, it's just intrinsically entertaining. I mean, I don't know whether it advances our understanding of anything, but like, who cares about that at this point? Like, purely entertainment sort of trumps that at every level, in terms of what people want to consume about football. That does seem to be the way things are going.
Yeah. All right. And let's just finally finish on an upcoming announcement from IFAB, which is that they're going to trial sin bins. And that would mean a blue card. Players could be sent to a sin bin for 10 minutes for dissent or for a cynical foul. We haven't got the full details of it yet because, the announcement hasn't happened. But obviously it would have a fairly substantial impact on the game and the way that it is officiated. I mean, just broad thoughts on the idea of the sin bin in professional football versus perhaps, you know, proper implementation of the card system, or is the card system now, the yellow red card system, you know, are there too many decisions that are showing that there are flaws with this and it's about time perhaps something changed in the game? Because, you know, you can see certain fouls that aren't really, they maybe deserve a little bit more than a yellow card, but not a red card. And there are often soft red cards for two yellows, which, you know, in the in the grand scheme of things, you don't want to see, generally speaking, players sent off for very, very little. So this could be sort of a halfway house between, you know, what would be ordinarily a soft red card. It gives, you know, the team in question a chance to, you know, dig in for 10 minutes and get their 11 men back when, you know, the situation doesn't necessarily merit a red card. So, you know, have you any thoughts on this, particularly in the era where, you know, VAR was introduced to help us get more things right, but only seems to have helped us get things increasingly wrong in ways that we've never seen before?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think this is necessary. You know, I mean, I feel as though we're in a phase of kind of tinkering with refereeing. I mean, when I say tinkering, obviously the VAR thing was a huge change in refereeing, like a transformative change in refereeing, which in my opinion has made the game worse. This is like more sort of let's change some things. And you always just end up thinking of Father Ted, you know, fixing the dent in his car. And you know, at the end of it, you're like, what are we doing here? Like every time they bring in some change, there are some unintended consequences of it. And we've seen so much of this type of thing happening with VAR. The net effect of it all, of the VAR experience to me, has been just to make refereeing much more central to the game,
yeah,
and much more controversial than it was. When in fact, the whole point of it in theory at the outset was, well, we'll have better decisions and people will be less angry about referees and there'll be less screaming about referees. And of course, it's actually just meant there's more refereeing to be done. Smaller and smaller things are being refereed and re-refereed, and people are getting angry over smaller and smaller injustices. This blue card thing just seems like a new way of sort of confusing the picture. It's like, is that a red? Is it a yellow? Or is it a blue? What, you know, there are more mistakes. There are more mistakes. It opens up new fields of incompetence for the referees can sort of plunge into. I just don't really get it. Like, if it's dissent, then that should be a yellow card. Like, what we're talking about, a blue card for dissent? Is that if you call the referee? Like, is there a list of blue words that there's yellow words like you can say, yeah, to the ref, and then if you call them a cheat or something else, it's a blue word. Ugh, I don't, or maybe cheat is red. I don't know. Like, it's just like, what is this? And the fundamental problem with football, with refereeing, is the VAR. The referee is no longer the referee. People expect the referees to be able to see everything and judge it accurately without ever accepting that in the case of many of these decisions, there is no correct decision. It's just a matter of how you interpret a situation. And people can look at the same thing. We know this. People can look at the same incident and come to different conclusions about what the right decision about it should be.
Yeah.
Like, he's clearly got his, that's clearly a deliberate handball versus, no, it's not, that ball's bounced up and it's hit him there. Well, his hand shouldn't be there. Or, oh, look, he's actually made contact with the ball slightly before versus, you can't go through an opponent like that, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's like a million different things like this. And like, there actually is no correct decision. But there is going to be people who are going to be angry with any given decision. And when everyone sat there looking at the video replay for 3 or 4 minutes, and then the referee issues a decision, it makes it more annoying to be on the wrong end of that decision.
Yeah.
Because at least it's so really it's, you know what, they're talking about how this is, Florentino Perez, for example, when he's going on about the Super League, one of his talking points is always, young people don't watch football anymore, which, you know, I'm not sure about it. It's a convenient thing for him to say, and I think it probably has something to do with a lot of football being behind paywalls for a start.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, the Champions League in a lot of European countries is a sort of a pay TV thing. We're a little bit luckier in Ireland in that respect, but in a lot of places it's not on free-to-air television. Okay, so that's a problem. But you know what one obvious shortcoming is between real football and, like, video football, video game, PlayStation football, is there is no VAR review in like you don't in like in a video game you do not have a 4 minute break while these like middle-aged men stand around going, oh, you know what, what's it going to be, you know, this is ridiculous, like it's just such nonsense to have everybody standing and waiting. Like, do we have the time as a planet? Do we have the time to be sitting around for 4 or 5 minutes waiting for a bunch of bald guys to issue a wrong decision about something that they could have issued a wrong decision about at the moment it happened and we all would have got on with it?
Yeah.
Like, do we really, like, it's just, how is this an improvement? Like, how is it an improvement to have like 10 minutes of stoppage time? Like 90 minutes isn't 90 minutes anymore. How is this better, really? Like, I mean, it's still a game, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it just sort of takes longer. No one knows when it's going to be finished. There are still wrong decisions. It's just they take longer. This is just, I know you asked me about blue cards. I'm just kind of looking at this going, all right, instead of just erasing or rolling back the mistakes they've already inflicted on the game, they're just like thinking up new ways to sort of complicate things. I don't really understand what it is. But I suppose if you're IFAB, you know, you got to justify your existence somehow, you know. Yeah. Well, we've got to come up with some ideas, you know. They want us to come up with some ideas. So you just, I don't know, spout out this. Yeah. Look, I'm sure we'll all be, there'll be some really exciting blue card controversy next year that everyone will.
I like this from Jamie O'Hara, former Tottenham player. Blue cards getting introduced. The game is absolutely gone. Seriously.
Basically, I agree with him. You know, he basically just said what I've said, but like much, much pithier. You know, it didn't take as long to.
Well, he said, take me back to the early 2000s. Lampard, Scholes, Gerrard, Stoke on a Tuesday night. Crouchy doing the robot. What the hell happened?
that is brilliant. Now that's a brilliant tweet.
There's I mean, the,
that's a what a time capsule that is, you know. And the early 2000s. I mean, 2000s. My you know, to me, the game was already gone by the early 2000s.
The halcyon days of football in the Premier League, of course. All right. Yeah. Well, look, we'll see what happens with blue cards and all the rest. We better leave it there, though. Ken, as ever, great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Good to talk to you, Andrew. Talk to you soon. Good luck.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Thank you very much indeed to Ken. You can find him on Twitter. He is at Ken Earlies, and of course on Second Captains, which you can find out more about if you don't know anything about them at secondcaptains.com. Right. Let's leave it there for this particular episode. No fucking around at the end of this one because we still have plenty to do today. As ever, thank you very much indeed for being with us. Hope you enjoyed the show and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, and in the presence of your Royal Highness, please welcome to the stage the Poet Laureate, Sir James Montagu O'Hara. Blue cards getting introduced. The game has absolutely gone. Seriously, take me back to the early 2000s. Lampard, Scholes, Gerrard, Stoke on a Tuesday night, Crouchy doing the robot. What the hell happened?
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.